Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, with my terrific co-host, Kath.
You forgot my name.
Again.
Carol Butler.
Carol Butler. That old girlfriend of mine keeps popping up. It's terrible. Carol Butler. And we have another great show today. And it's spring, finally.
Sort of,
yeah. A few folks who don't live in the metropolitan area, we finally got a beautiful day yesterday.
Right.
Even though it rained late in the afternoon. Did you get that shower in the afternoon?
We did, yes. Yeah. I got caught in it, in fact.
Yeah. So,
But we've officially decided, when this happens in New York, we've had a couple of nice days, and we decide that spring is here.
We decide,
right?
Yes.
And I wore sandals today and got my summer bag out, and as far as I'm concerned, even though it looks like it's going to rain, that spring is here.
Yeah, so spring is here. So we're going to celebrate some of the holidays associated with spring on this show. And the first one we're going to talk about is Earth Day. Because Earth Day was Friday. And if folks who are long-term listeners know, last year I got two beautiful little kids I interviewed for Earth Day. But they were both away this year in Florida, you know, celebrating the whole holiday. So maybe when they come back, I'll get them on.
That would be nice.
That would be good. They were very good last year. So I'm going to talk about Earth Day today. And I asked Carol a question before we went on the air. And I'll ask the question on the air now. Carol, I said, what does Goldilocks have to do with Earth Day or the Earth?
Right. Now that you gave me time to think about it, I still don't know the answer.
Okay. Well, I'm going to quote from the nursery story.
Okay.
About... You remember Goldilocks and the Three Bears?
I do.
I think it's etched in all of our heads.
I do, yes.
So so Goldilocks, who was invited to visit the Three Bears, she was in there and they weren't home, and then they came home, right? So, this porridge is too hot, Goldilocks exclaimed. She tasted the porridge from the second bowl. This porridge is too cold.
Right.
So she tasted the last bowl of porridge. Ah, this porridge is just right, she said happily, and she ate it all up. So that happened through the story. She tried the beds, I think, and one was too big. One was
chairs as well.
And the chairs and all. So what does that have to do with the Earth?
Still no idea.
Okay. So the Earth is referred to by astronomers and other people as a Goldilocks planet.
Really?
Yes. It's a planet that falls within a star's habitable zone.
Okay.
That our star is the Sun.
Right.
And the name is often specifically used for planets close to the size of the Earth. The name comes from the story of Goldilocks with the little girl, blah, 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 blah. And likewise, when she says that,
it's just right.
Okay.
Some planets close to the Sun are too hot, and some further away are too cold.
Now you got it.
Okay.
Likewise, a planet following the Goldilocks principle is one that is neither too close to the Sun or too far away from a star to rule out liquid water on its surface.
Right.
And thus, life, as we know it, flourishes on our planet.
Excellent.
Okay? So that's why... You can use that expression.
That's very nice.
The Goldilocks planet, or the Goldilocks, what does he call it here? Not syndrome, but anyway, The Goldilocks principle.
Okay.
So life as we know it on the earth has thrived. Probably started, if the earth is about, the sun is about 4 billion years old. So about when the earth was about 1 billion years old, I think life started. We don't know how it started, but it certainly flourished. Because now we have, how many species do we have on the earth? Over 3 million species, and that number is growing.
Right.
Because almost every week we find a new species. Well, there's so many scientists now investigating, especially in entomology.
Right, micromoths.
There you go. How big are they?
Very small. That's the hot topic in entomology.
Oh, yeah, it's micromoths.
Right.
Okay.
Everybody ignored them before. They looked like a little speck.
Right.
But now that we have the techniques, everybody's studying them.
Okay. So what else makes Earth unusual from other planets? And what do you need for life? That's as we know it. I keep saying as we know it because if there's life somewhere else in the universe, we have no idea what it would be like. But for life as we know it, you need certain parameters. Okay? So life as we know it is based on carbon. Okay? And our atmosphere is a special atmosphere. It's 79% nitrogen, 20% oxygen, 1% argon, and variable amounts of water vapor and carbon dioxide. So we know for life on Earth as we know it, you need carbon-based cells, like hydrocarbons.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has heard about hydrocarbons and carbons. You need water.
Right.
You need some form of energy to transport up the food chain.
Right.
Okay, and that energy, one example of it is photosynthesis. And we get photosynthesis from the sun.
Right.
The energy of the sun is taken up by the green plants, and I hope you folks remember that from your science courses, general science courses. And our whole food chain and food system, almost everything depends on the sun.
Correct.
And when we went to school, probably Carol and myself, we learned that everything on Earth is dependent on the sun, right? All the food we eat and all that, you can trace almost any food back to the sunshine.
Right.
The green plants, okay? Even if you talk about meat, the cows eat green grass and other things. The grass is the photosynthesis, and therefore we can have meat.
Right.
Okay. Subsequently, we found out there is an ecosystem on Earth that doesn't depend on the sun. That's at the bottom of the oceans,
mm-hmm.
the thermal vent communities, which are these undersea volcanoes. The sun has nothing to do with that.
Right.
And also, one food you could mention maybe is a fungus, like mushrooms.
Right.
But not quite sure if they need sunlight. They usually grow in dark places,
right.
So they don't need sunlight. They're not green plants. Okay, so life on Earth, we have a lot of liquid water. In fact, 70% of the Earth's surface is water. So we are really a water planet. And don't forget to look at the pictures online after the show is over. I have this beautiful picture of Earth taken from space. You know, it's become famous with a blue water and white clouds
mm-hmm.
on it. It's this beautiful picture of our Earth taken from, I think, from the space capsule.
Right,
the asteroids took that picture. Okay, so take a look at that, our beautiful Earth. And the other things that people don't think of, that our Earth is very active geologically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes to
Well, we think of it now since we just had all this volcano and the tsunami and earthquakes. You know.
Yes, so those are destructive because people are living in those zones.
Right.
Of earthquake zones and volcano zones. But the Earth is really alive in that sense
mm-hmm.
because what all those things are doing is recycling everything on the Earth. So picture a volcano being formed and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and then it blows its top. So what the Earth is doing is recycling those minerals, bringing those minerals up from the deep Earth, from in the mantle
mm-hmm.
where there's molten rock, or down below to the core, which is really molten, and bringing it up to the surface. And we mine all those minerals. There's a lot of iron in volcanoes and
mm-hmm.
a lot of other things. So we're very active geographically. And you can see our moon at night. Our moon is not active geographically. It's dead. There's no hot center to the moon. There's no nothing recycling in it.
Right.
And you only see the moon as it is covered with impact craters from meteors. Okay, and we have plate tectonics, which
yes, we
is
do.
Also recycling. That plate tectonics is the cause of a lot of earthquakes.
Right.
Okay, that's also recycling. And we also have a strong magnetic field for such a small planet. Okay, we have this, if anybody owns a compass and you look at your compass, the compass points north. Well, why does it do that? It does that because we have this huge magnetic field around the Earth, okay? And the lines of force of this magnetic field are north and south.
Right.
Okay? It also has to do with the core of the Earth, which is iron. Mm-hmm. And the core, the Earth has two cores, a solid core in the middle and a liquid core around it. And when I say liquid, it's not liquid like water. It's more like molasses.
Right, molten maybe.
Yeah, but very slow moving. Mm. That slowly moves around the core, making like a dynamo,
right,
which is the way electricity is produced. Okay, and we have a big satellite in proportion to our size. Our moon is our satellite, and that produces the tides on the Earth. So we have high tide and low tide, which is a very nice thing to have because we get all these critters living in the intertidal zone. And also, it has to do with, not with the Earth's axis, but actually the tide, the moon.
Phases of the moon.
Phases of the moon have to do with the tides on Earth. Okay, so that's another thing that makes the Earth habitable and a living planet. So do you have any questions about the Earth, Carol? I have all these statistics here about the size of it, the distance from the sun.
Well,
of the
tell Earth. Us about it, sure.
Okay, so you know that our Earth is not the closest planet to the sun.
Correct.
Okay, Mercury is the closest.
Then Venus.
Then Venus, right. And then our Earth.
Right.
And then beyond our Earth is Mars, and then the gas giant planets, right, which are way out there. So our Earth is more or less 93 million miles from the sun.
Okay.
Okay. And that distance seems to be the perfect distance for a planet like Earth. Okay. If we were closer than that, like Mars, it would be so hot that water would boil and we wouldn't have any liquid water. Mm. Okay. And the same with Venus. Temperatures on Venus are very extreme, from very high to very low. Mm-hmm. We don't have extreme temperatures on Earth. We have.
We think we do.
We think we do
I
in
guess
the winter.
Compared to that,
right.
Yeah.
So on Earth, we have water in these different forms. We have liquid water. We have ice. We have gaseous water, clouds. Okay? So we have water that can change, can transition in relating to temperature and other things.
Right.
So we have plenty of water on the Earth. And if we take care of it, we'll have it for a long time.
Well, and the water moderates our temperature changes, right?
Ocean,
that's why our...
Right. That's a good point. The oceans are a moderator of temperatures. For example, if you live out on Montauk, in that area, in the winter, Montauk's probably pretty cold because it's very windy out there. Right. But we have friends who live in East Hampton, and the winters out there are not as severe as they are here because while the ocean gets cold, it doesn't get cold overnight. It takes a long time for it to cool down, and then it takes a long time for it to warm up in the spring and the summer. So that's a moderating influence,
right,
because you know the air gets cold right away. So having a planet that's 70% water is a great moderating influence on our climate. And if you live up in the North Pole or the South Pole, you certainly have extremes in temperature,
right,
but still...
But nothing like what you'd have on Mars or Venus.
Sure,
right?
You'd have a minus... zero, way down. Okay, so that's some things about the Earth. And, you know, we're talking about all these problems now that we're having on the Earth because of greenhouse effect and overpopulation,
mm-hmm,
and water resources becoming scarce. But we are lucky where we live. And most of those problems have not affected us too much yet, except this year we're having all the violent weather. It's unusual to have all those cyclones in the Midwest.
That's
and tornadoes,
right, yeah.
And other conditions. But we'll see on a long-term basis if that's unusual or what. My theory is that the Earth is slowly warming up due to greenhouse gases and our using of fossil fuels. But also, remember, 10,000 years ago, we were in the ice age.
It's a normal cycle that may be exacerbated by
Right. Because the glaciers, which covered it right where we're talking right now, advanced, and the Earth cooled down, and that made a lot of effects on the animals and the critters and the people who were living at that time. There were people 10,000 years ago. nobody was living right here in this spot right. in Bushwick because they couldn't rent an apartment. It was very expensive in those days. No, but anyhow, so my theory is that the Earth is slowly coming out of the Ice Age,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, we're making it worse because of these greenhouse
right.
gases.
We're speeding up the process.
We're speeding up the process. Okay, so what I want you folks to do, remember that the Earth is beautiful. Okay, now what about other places? Have we found life anywhere else? Carol, what do you think?
Well,
besides in New Jersey.
I think we're not sure. We have little sounds and little indications that there might be something.
Okay, well, we have been sending a space telescope now that's up in space, and like the Hubble and the Kepler, which is another telescope I think that we launched from the space shuttle or one of the other vehicles, and we can see pretty far out in our Milky Way galaxy,
mm-hmm.
and we have discovered, I think the last count was about 1,200 planets orbiting other suns
mm.
in our Milky Way galaxy.
It's inconceivable to
yeah,
me.
It is. Just remember that our solar system is one little
right.
arm of the Milky Way galaxy. So I'll just tell you how big our Milky Way galaxy is. Okay, now I'm going to talk about light years.
Okay.
Because I can't talk about miles because we don't have enough zeros to put this number in miles. So when we talk about large distances, like the distance from the sun to the Earth is 93 million miles. That's considered one astronomical unit, okay? But even that isn't a big enough unit when
right.
you're talking about sizes in the galaxy.
Right.
So
what is a light year? I don't remember.
Okay, a light year is the distance that light can travel in 1 year.
Okay.
Okay, and if you remember when you went to Bronx Science,
mm-hmm.
the speed of light?
186,000 miles a minute, miles an hour.
Second.
Miles a second.
All right,
okay.
Great. Okay, so light travels 186,000 miles a second.
Right.
In 1 second, okay? So we have found a planet circling the star Gliese, which the astronomers always find these names. A lot of them are from mythology. Or named after somebody's brother-in-law or something.
That's right.
Like that.
Or their right. girlfriend, right.
Or their girlfriend, yeah. So Gliese is currently believed to be the fourth planet of the red dwarf star Gliese.
Okay.
Okay. Approximately 20 light years distance from the Earth. Now, how far is that from the Earth? If one light year is
186,000 miles a second
yeah.
times however many seconds there are in a year.
Okay, it comes out to 6 trillion miles in
okay,
a year.
Very
so
good.
Light can travel 6 trillion miles in a year. So if it's 20 light years from the Earth, it's 20 times 6
right.
trillion, and I don't know what that comes out to.
Very far.
Very far. A lot of zeros.
Right.
You use up all your zeros in your computer. That's bad. Okay, so we know that. How did we find this planet, Gliese? It's so far away. Well, one way we find these planets is that we look at them with all kinds of telescopes, that infrared, ultraviolet, X-ray, and all that stuff. And if we see this red dwarf star, I mean a star that's very small and that's gone through all its phases and it's cooling down, okay, and we can see that the light from this star blinks as we watch it,
mm-hmm.
then we say that there's a planet passing around it.
Ah.
And as the planet passes in the eye of the telescope, then we know that there's something there. So this one is the fourth one out from Gliese.
Mm-hmm.
So we're calling this one a possible one for life, but we have no idea.
Oh, yeah, that seems pretty
and
far.
And we probably never will find
right.
out.
It's pretty far-fetched,
because it's so far away
yeah. Yeah.
that we don't know. So we don't have a lot of time left on this first half of the show. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to go to our photo gallery.
Okay.
Because I want to finish this talk about the Earth with something beautiful on the Earth. So Saturday, I went to Central Park and I took a walk and it was raining. So I took pictures in the rain
mm.
of Central Park. All the spring plants are coming up. So take a look at those pictures and a reminder to get out. It's springtime. Go to any place in your neighborhood that's green, even your own backyard, and it's spring. So the Earth is really beautiful in spring, especially in the Northern Hemisphere
yes.
where it's spring. The Southern Hemisphere, it's becoming autumn. It's
right.
going to winter.
Right.
Okay? And I'll be back after the break And I'm going to talk about the two holidays that happened this month, Passover and Easter.
Very good. All right. Thank you. We'll be back shortly.
Is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Join Linda Palacio for A Taste of the Past every Thursday at 12 p.m. as she indulges her curiosities about food, cooking, drinking, and dining of the past by taking a journey through culinary history. Linda interviews authors, scholars, friends, and chroniclers to learn about what was eaten, where, and how, from as long ago as ancient Mesopotamia and Rome, right up to the grazing tables and deli counters of today. The show underscores food as a lively link between present and past cultures. Again, that's Thursday at 12 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Okay, this is The Naturalist. We are back. It's Carol Butler and Bernie Wides. And Bernie is going to talk about the holidays of spring.
Right. Easter and Passover. Now, we're sort of ignoring other holidays from other cultures. So I'm just talking about the Western stuff. I didn't do any research on things from India or Africa or all those spring festivals in those countries. I did mostly on Christianity and Judaism.
Since we only have 15 minutes.
Yeah, we only
have
15 minutes, so you know there's so much information, a lot of mythology and a lot of customs and all that. So Carol, very quickly, did you celebrate when you were a kid?
I liked Easter. I occasionally went to a Seder.
Yeah.
I came from a mixed family, so we had a little bit of everything. Sometimes a friend would have a Seder, and I would be invited. And I liked Easter because my Italian Catholic girlfriends would go to church, and we would all get dressed up
right.
and get hats.
That was the best part.
And walk hats, around. Right. That was the best.
Yeah, great.
That was how I celebrated.
All right. Well, my family was Jewish Orthodox, so I really went through the whole thing, and it was, you know, it was my history, so that's it. Okay, so I have a question here. How did the Jewish Jewish Passover customs come to be connected with Christian Passover customs?
I didn't know they were connected.
Absolutely. Okay.
He likes to ask me these questions at the beginning of a show where I have no idea.
Okay. Jewish Passover customs came to be connected with Christian Passover customs because the early Christians were in fact Jews who kept the observances of all the Jewish festivals and on the same dates in the Jewish calendar as the Jewish people celebrated them. Okay? The early Christians substituted traditional Jewish symbolism and interpretations for the Passover Seder or festive meal and the Passover holiday as a whole with their own version of symbolisms and interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
So the holiday of Easter is built on the traditions of Passover. Okay?
Although they seem so different. I'm just thinking, somebody I know was telling me that he spent a lot of money on seafood for Good Friday. That was their special holiday meal.
That's a custom in some cultures. Because they didn't want to eat meat because of the crucifixion.
Right, and I've been missing out on quesadillas all month because he doesn't eat meat on Wednesdays and Fridays.
You have to see him different days.
Wednesday is the day that we usually get quesadillas, they don't make them without meat. So
okay.
I'm glad that Easter has come.
Right, good, okay. That was Lent all those days.
Yes, too, that's right.
Yeah, the early Christian, I said that they substituted Jewish symbolism and gave it new interpretations. Okay, so in the New Testament, instructions are given concerning the observing the Passover festival. These instructions are found in 1 Corinthians. Purge out, therefore, the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you are unleavened. So that talks about the unleavened bread or matzah. So what the Jewish tradition is, before the Passover festival, you're supposed to search your house and get rid of all the old bread and anything that's related to bread for the holiday.
Right.
In fact, it's like spring cleaning.
That's what it really is.
So in Corinthians, it says to do the same thing, but it's referring to the person, that you are an old lump of unleavened.
Interesting.
And you want to become a new
lump. You want to become a matzah.
Right. Okay. Okay. I'll just read that last part. Therefore, let us keep the feast of unleavened bread, which always followed Passover, since in the Hebrew Bible, the Passover of Egypt festival was originally, now listen to this, a combination of two pre-Passover celebrations of Egyptian festivals observed by early Middle Eastern peoples, a one-day festival of sacrificing a paschal lamb.
Okay.
And this predates Passover.
Passover, yeah. Yeah,
paschal lamb, followed by a seven-day festival of eating unleavened bread. Now, so where did the Jews get it from?
Interesting, right.
Sounds like they got it from the Egyptians. They were living in Egypt.
Yeah.
At the time, right? Initially, Easter was celebrated on the same day as the Jewish Passover due to Jesus being crucified on the day of the Jewish Passover on the 15th day of Nisan in the Jewish calendar. That's the name of the month.
Right.
It was only during the Ecumenical Council of, I think it's Nicaea, N-I-C-E-A, in 325 CE, Common Era, that the patriarchs of the Roman Catholic Church decided that Easter would always fall on the first Sunday after the first full moon of spring, after the vernal equinox.
Okay.
Okay? No sooner than March 21st, meaning the first full moon appears on or after March 21st. This gets complicated. The vernal equinox, and no later than April 25th. Now, for Orthodox Christians, they refer to Greek Orthodox and I don't know if Russian Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox Christian. For Orthodox Christians who refer to Easter, even to this day, as Pascha, P-A-S-C-H-A, which is pretty close to Pesach in Hebrew, or Orthodox Easter, there is an agreement with the Roman Church concerning when Easter should be celebrated, meaning on the Sunday following the first full moon after the spring or vernal equinox. But with the exception that Pascha, or the other way they pronounce it, always occurs on the first Sunday after the Jewish Passover, because the gospel says Jesus died the day after eating the Passover Seder and rose from the dead on the following Sunday.
Huh.
So there's the connection.
I didn't know that. Okay.
So the Last Supper was the Seder.
Right.
So we're closely related in religion. Okay. So then there's a lot of confusion here because there are two calendars. The Julian calendar, named after Julius Caesar, and the other one was the, the Gregorian calendar, named after Pope Gregory, who fixed the date of Easter. So there's still a sort of a dichotomy here of the Eastern Orthodox, even though they had this agreement with the Western Orthodox Church on when it should be. But they finally settled that, I think, in there was another Ecumenical Council. And they decided on the date. So here we are with both religions pretty closely related.
I think that the takeaway is that the Last Supper is the first day of Passover.
Right.
That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, so in a nutshell, which is a good place to put this because it's very complicated. In a nutshell, early Christians believed that just as the Hebrews were given redemption and physical liberation by God from slavery and oppression in Egypt, as is told in the Passover story, which is the Seder. When you go to a Seder, they tell you the story of the Passover, you know, of the 10 plagues, and everybody probably knows that story by now. Do you know that story about the 10 plagues? No. Okay, well, I'll tell you in a minute. Okay, so they were freed from oppression
right.
during Passover.
Right.
Okay, and Moses led them out into the wilderness.
That I remember, okay. Yes.
Christians were given redemption and liberation through Jesus, who represents their God in human form. Mm. So here's another close connection.
Right.
And Jesus is referred to the Paschal Lamb. Jesus is the sacrifice for redemption.
Right.
And in the Jewish custom, it was a baby lamb that was sacrificed mm-hmm. to God even before it was a Jewish thing in the Egyptian
right.
thing, because it was the beginning of the spring harvest.
Right.
And to
placate
right. or pacify the gods right. that they should have a good harvest, they sacrificed this baby lamb to the God. So the Jewish story came about that when Moses wanted to let my people go and go out and leave Egypt because they were in slavery and bondage, God sent 10 plagues.
Okay.
And the last plague was the worst one. It was the slaying of the firstborn
okay.
of the Egyptian children, because the Egyptians were worried. One of the things that brought this on, the Egyptians were worried that the Jews were becoming too numerous in Egypt, and he was afraid that if they ever turned against him, the Pharaoh, they would be like, you know, like what's going on today in Egypt,
mm-hmm.
just like
mm-hmm.
what happened in
mm-hmm.
Egypt today. So he told the soldiers to kill the firstborn of the Jews. And that's the story of Moses. Remember?
Does that have also to do with Abraham and Isaac?
No, this is after that.
It's after, okay.
Yeah, after or before, I don't remember.
Because that's also...
Yeah, when Isaac was brought to, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I don't remember the chronology of it, but I just remember that... one of the daughters of the Pharaoh was bathing at the river, and she saw this basket, and there was an infant in it,
yes.
and
oh,
she
yeah.
saved its life,
that was
Moses,
right.
okay, Moses of the bulrushes, and so that's the connection there. So the tenth plague was the worst plague because it was the slaying of the Egyptians' firstborn, and so the angel of death was going to come and slay all the firstborns, but except the Jewish firstborns, because they were going to be preserved and saved, and this would force the king to let them go. So the Passover means to pass over the houses mm-hmm. of the angel of death. And the way they marked the houses is they took when they sacrificed the lamb, and they took a bone of the lamb and smeared blood over their doorposts. Mm. So the angel of death would know that this is a Jewish house and not to slay the firstborn. Mm. So that's in a nutshell.
Interesting, yeah.
That's a big nut, but like a coconut shell, because there's so much to talk about here. Okay? All right, so I just want to finish with this last paragraph, and then I'm going to leave this, and I'm going to go further back in history, because all these holidays are based on earlier holidays, and most of them are pagan and agricultural holidays.
Right.
Well, okay. The two early spring festivals are the sacrificing of a Paschal lamb and the festival of unleavened bread were meant to placate the unknown and were performed out of fear and not knowing what would be.
Okay.
Because they thought they were gods, but you had to placate the gods by doing sacrifices and all kinds of other things, right?
Which is, of course, still done in many
cultures.
Done.
Yeah. Yeah. The transformation of the primitive spring festivals into the Jewish Passover and then the Christian Passover and the Christian Easter marked a profound shift in emphasis. The heart of the celebration becomes centered on human conduct and conscience, not the whim of natural forces outside of human control. In Judaism, Moses led his people to freedom from tyranny, and divine justice was ministered to the hard-hearted of Pharaoh. In Christianity, an innocent Jesus dies on the cross, betrayed by his friends and the state. His resurrection offers the prospect of forgiveness and human redemption. True, both stories offer divine grace, yet both imply we are also complicit in our own destiny. With that spark of intuition is born the seductive idea that we can change destinies, but if we make the right choices.
Hmm.
Okay. From there, the modern world was born, the idea that we can make a better tomorrow. So this is the guy who wrote this article, that's his conclusions. So it sounds very nice. It's a nice idea that we have some control over our destinies and all that.
I'm not sure how it dovetails with praying and asking God for blessings and worrying about getting, not curses in exactly,
but... Or eating the right foods at the right time.
Right. Or confessing. So, I mean, there's getting absolution. All of that sort of doesn't say you have a whole lot of free will.
Well, you have to be a believer
to
believe all those customs and traditions and beliefs.
Right.
And you believe that you're doing that because your God has told you to do this, or a prophet has told you to do this. And in a way, it's like the old religions where the gods and goddesses had to be placated or pacified. So in a way, it's the same way. So it's up to the individual to believe what they want. Okay, and if you believe in those religions, then you do all those things.
Right.
And if you don't believe in them, like I don't believe in them, I don't do anything. I celebrated Easter yesterday, I think I told you, with taking a walk in Central Park to look at the beautiful plants and trees, and I wore my special Eddie Bauer Easter hat, which is...
You celebrated spring.
I celebrated spring.
Right.
That's my celebration of spring. The earth comes back and provides us with all these great things. So I would, if I was religious, I'd probably be a nature worshiper.
Right. I went to Trader Joe for Easter.
Ah, there you go. Trader Joe.
It was almost empty. There was no line. It was a wonderful thing to do on Easter.
That was good. Is your Trader Joe underground like mine is?
No. Mm-hmm. Is yours underground?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a new Trader Joe on 72nd Street and Broadway, but it's down under the ground.
Oh.
So you can see the roots of everything now coming up. That's what it is. No. Okay, so now... Jack, how much time do I have left? 2, 3, 5 minutes? Okay. Okay, so I'm going to end up now talking about, we're going back in time before there was an Easter and before there was a Passover, when there were all these so-called pagan religions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to dwell on the name, the word Easter, because it has a very interesting history. Okay? In Old English, this is before... Let's see, when the tribes were still living in England, there wasn't a central government or anything, but each section of England, I think, had their own ruler.
Okay.
I don't know English history too much, but this is back, way back. The Old English Estere, spelled E-O-S-T-R-E, and the High German Ostara are the names of a Germanic goddess whose Anglo-Saxon month, Estora month, or in Old English, I can't pronounce it, Estere month, has given its name to the festival of Easter. So there was a month that was called Easter month in old High English. Okay?
It makes me think of the word estrus, right?
That's where it comes from.
Okay,
estrus and estrogen.
Right.
Comes from that root
of
estare or estra.
Okay. Which is a monthly cycle. That's where estrus is.
Oh, good. I didn't think about that. That's right. It's a monthly cycle, and it's the female hormone.
Right.
Okay. So, Easter month, I'm saying it this way because it's too hard to pronounce it together, Estor Monath, I don't know, was the equivalent to the month of April. And that feast held in her honor during that month had died out by the time of this writing. I mean, this guy wrote this in the 1800s.
Okay.
By that time, most of that had died out because Christianity had come. Okay, the possibility of a common Germanic goddess called Astora was examined in detail in the 19th century. So the 19th century is 1800s.
Right?
Okay, so linguists have identified the goddess as a Germanic form of the reconstructed Proto-Indo-European goddess of the dawn.
Okay.
So here... There's some references that she was not only was she a fertility goddess, because she was a springtime goddess, but she was the goddess of the dawn, that she brought the sun up into the sky.
Right.
Okay? All right. And some theories connect Estore with records of German Easter customs, including hares and eggs.
Oh, okay? There's where the bunny rabbits come
from. Yeah, if you always wondered where the bunny rabbits come into the Easter celebration, because as we... Well, mostly no. Rabbits are mammals, and they don't lay eggs.
Right.
They do live births like we do.
Right.
Okay? I mean, if you want to look inside the womb, they are certainly eggs, and sperm, but we don't lay eggs. There, I think one or two mammals that do. I mean, the one that lives in Australia, I think, the duck-footed platypus, that's a big exception. But almost all mammals have live births.
Yes.
So what does the rabbit have to do with it? And rabbit
Here's
and eggs.
Here's the origin from the Germanic custom.
Yes. So be sure to look on the website at the picture I put up of the goddess Astora, because here she is floating through the sky with a rabbit at her side, okay? And also little angels like Putis from the Roman
But what's the
tradition.
Connection? She's just associated with rabbits or
No,
what?
The thing is, there was a story that I tracked down once that said that, first of all, the rabbit is a symbol of fertility and fecundity because they reproduce a lot.
Right.
So way back in history, the rabbit was used as that symbol
That's
for
fair.
Reproduction
yes.
and all that stuff. But I read a story once that she came across an injured bird.
Mm-hmm.
And even though she was a goddess, she couldn't fix it. So she turned it into a rabbit because she was very good with rabbits.
Right.
And the rabbit retained the ability to lay eggs.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so how's that for convoluted
really,
stuff?
That really is convoluted, yeah.
But it's really the symbolism of the egg and the symbolism of the rabbit. The egg is for rebirth and new birth and springtime.
Right.
Okay? Because a lot of times the young animals were born in the spring.
Right.
You know, they'd be inseminated over the winter. The spring came, they would give birth and young rams and goats and sheep and all that stuff. So it was rebirth. Okay, so this picture shows the goddess Astra flying through the heavens surrounded by Roman-inspired puti. And puti are little cherubs.
Right.
Okay? Beams of light and animals.
It's also the animals, a lot of animals born in the spring because that's when food is available.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's very part of the cycle.
Yes, the winter time is known as the starving time
right.
to a lot of peoples because they ran out of food. They,
right.
It was too bad. Okay, so and in this picture, Germanic people look up at the goddess from the realm below. So it's sort of a nice picture. So if you get a chance, look at the picture of Estera or Astra or however you pronounce it. Okay, so I'm going to read a little bit more about this, this account by this one guy who wrote a book. It's called De Temporum Ratione. And I guess that means time. Temporum is time. Ratione and probably the
rational,
real times. Rational real, times,
yeah.
real time. Okay, he wrote about Easter month, the month of the goddess Estera. And here's the English translation from the Latin. It says, Astra month has a name which is now translated Paschal month.
Okay.
There's your Passover coming,
right.
Paschal month, which was once called after a goddess of theirs named Estera, in whose honor feasts were celebrated in that month. Now they designate that Paschal season by her name. Okay?
Right.
Calling the joys of the new rite by the time-honored name of the old observance.
There you go.
Okay, so there's Pesach.
And also Pascha, the name,
right.
the early name for Easter.
Right. Okay, so, and he called her a spring-like fertility goddess. Okay, there's a dispute whether she was a goddess of the sunrise or a fertility goddess, but, you know, she could have been both. She was a really powerful woman, so... All right, so, but the thing having to do with the sunrise is very interesting when we get back to Easter.
I think it's interesting that she changed the bird into a rabbit, and that's why the rabbit and eggs are involved. That's
right.
Also.
Okay. How much time left? 1 minute. Okay, I'll finish up my story about Astera. It says, we Germans to this day, I'm quoting from another book, call April Easter month. I can't say it in German. Okay. The great... A Christian festival, which usually falls in April or the end of March, bears the oldest of Old English names, and that's the name from Old English, and also for German. What kept the Easter, let's see, Easter, like the Anglo-Saxon, must in heathen religions have been denoted a higher being whose worship was so firmly rooted that the Christian teachers tolerated the name and applied it to one of their own grandest anniversaries. So the name of Astra became Easter because this god was so prevalent and powerful.
Right.
And the early Christian fathers were very smart because they slowly introduced the Christianity and overlaid it on these old holidays that fell at these times.
Right.
So that's why that Christ's rising is in spring and on Easter and Passover. Okay.
Very good.
Okay.
Very interesting stuff.
Okay, the one last thing I wanted to talk about is when she was, they thought she was a dawn, goddess of the dawn also. Because, you know, Easter morning, mm-hmm. when Christ arises, it's a big celebration. Mm-hmm. So it says that Astra seems therefore to have been the divinity of the radiant dawn, of upspringing light, a spectacle that brings joy and blessing, though whose meanings could be easily adopted by the resurrection day of the Christian God. Bonfires were lighted, this is before Christianity, at Easter, and according to popular belief of long standing, the moment the sun rises on Easter morning, the person gives three cheers and leaps up into the air and dances for joy because the sun has come up. Water drawn on Easter morning is like that on Christmas, holy and healing. Here also, heathen notions seem to have been grafted themselves on great Christian festivals. Maidens clothed in white, who at Easter, at the season of the returning spring, show themselves in clefts of the rock and on mountains, are suggestive of the ancient goddess. How's that?
Terrific.
Oh, yes. And then one last thing. I think I have probably about 30 seconds. Then, though long ages, a long time ago, there seems to have lingered among the people Easter games, so-called, which the church itself had to tolerate. I allude to especially the custom of Easter eggs and to the Easter tale, which preachers told from the pulpit for the people's amusement, connecting it with Christian reminiscences.
So there's the origin of Easter egg hunts.
Yes, and the last connection is hot cross buns for Easter?
Yes, yes.
Okay. He said, further, there was a custom of baked goods, and it was called pastry of a heathenish form. So, of course, they changed it by putting a cross on it.
That's right. Great. Yeah.
So these buns were baked at that time.
All
okay.
Right. I hear our music playing.
Okay. So there you have the old connections.
That's terrific.
Believe it or not, I researched this, and there are a lot of books on mythology that I took it from. And meanwhile, enjoy the two holidays, whichever one you want to celebrate. Or like me, just enjoying the spring.
Right.
And that's the end of this program. And next week's program will be completely different, Carol, right?
Completely different. It's also related to the spring. It's about mosquitoes.
Okay, mosquitoes. Love them or leave them or something
right.
like that. Okay, signing off.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. In 2010, EscapeMaker.com won an Emmy Award for their agritourism webisode, so this year they thought, why not bring agritourism and green getaway ideas right to you? Come to the Green Getaways Local Food and Travel Expo on April 30th at One Hanson Place, home of the Brooklyn Flea and former Williamsburg Savings Bank. Presented by Amtrak, Zipcar, and I Love New York, the carbon-free event will be a day filled with food, prizes, workshops, and kids' activities. Over 50 getaway destinations, from counties to local farms and bed and breakfasts within a day's drive or train ride of New York City, will be exhibiting on the main floor and in the huge bank vault downstairs. See what's hot in sustainable travel and receive special show-only discounts. Grow NYC will be doing workshops on the green market, and Appalachian Mountain Club will offer workshops on adventure bicycling and hiking via mass transit. EscapeMaker.com will be giving away over 50 getaway prizes, ranging from zipline adventure passes to an overnight stay at Mohonk Mountain House. Travel greener, eat local. Come to the expo on April 30th. Get your tickets now at www.escapemaker.com.